Telephone interview with Jeffrey Bartel, April 28th, 2008, by Kenneth Durr.
I want to begin by getting you into the state regulator's position and getting you getting some background.
Sure.
Did you go to Wisconsin?
I did. I have an undergraduate degree in economics, Wisconsin, and went on to law school at Wisconsin, graduated in 68.
Did you focus on securities law when you were in law school?
Not at all. In fact, the University of Wisconsin didn't even have a securities regulation course when I was in law school.
Huh.
I saw myself at that time as perhaps a labor lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
Took a lot of labor and employment courses, and, constitutional law, and a little bit of criminal law, very little corporate law, accounting or anything like that.
Well, how did you get into the specialty you're in now then? How did you become set up for a securities administrator's
right.
job?
Isn't it funny how those things happen? I began my legal career with the Attorney General's office as an assistant attorney general.
Uh-huh.
I passed up corporate opportunities, the corporate law opportunities, and wanted to do good deeds. So I went to work for the state, and I had a variety of assignments in the Attorney General's office, including consumer protection and criminal appeals. I represented the Division of Corrections and prisoner litigation,
mm-hmm.
and did a little prosecution as well. And after about three and a half years, I came to the attention of the governor by reason of work that I had done, staff work I had done for a task force to reorganize the court system of Wisconsin.
Hmm.
And we had developed a constitutional amendment for the judicial article of the state of Wisconsin. A lot of reorganization of the court system. When I finished that, I met with the governor and I told him I was either going to go back to the Attorney General's office or run for district attorney, which was kind of interesting.
Hmm.
And he said, how would you like to be securities commissioner? And I said, I didn't know we had one. And he said, well, why don't you, think about it and let me know. And I went back to the law school and talked to some of my professors there and read the statute, and I came back to the governor, and I said, I'd like to take the job.
Well, what was it that the professor said and that was in the statute that made you think this was a good idea?
Well, I was struck by the amount of discretion that the securities commissioner had in regulating the sale of securities and licensing and regulating broker-dealers and investment advisors. It was seemed to me to be right at the center of economic development in Wisconsin. It seemed like a very interesting subject.
Huh.
It wasn't that I had, as I say, I didn't have a lot of background.
Right.
When I talked to my wife about it, she said, what are you doing? You don't even know how to spell SEC. And I said, well, I think this is I'd like to try it. So I actually extended my leave of absence from the Attorney General's office.
Just in case it didn't work out?
Just in case it didn't work out. And I was confirmed by the State Senate and took office in December of 1972.
Right. Well, you must have had a pretty steep learning curve. Tell me a little bit about, the things that appeared right off that you thought this is going to take a lot of work.
Yeah. Well, I had, I was very fortunate, had an excellent staff. We had about, at that time, probably 25 people in the agency. And they knew what they were doing. And initially, I actually organized a basically, it was kind of an on-the-job training session for me,
mm-hmm.
but it was also designed to let everybody in the agency know what everybody else does. So we did an early morning presentation series so that each of the divisions in the office described their procedures, what they do,
mm-hmm.
Why they do it, what their issues are, and we all sat around. Not every it was voluntary; you didn't have to come, but I was there every day, and my new deputy, who remains my partner today at this law firm, Corp. Brady.
Who's that?
Conrad Goodkind.
Yeah. Okay.
And Conrad was actually worked with me on that court reform project that I mentioned. I appointed him deputy, and he, the two of us had a steep learning curve. But each of the divisions presented what they do, and it helped me understand the process. And then, of course, I had to jump right in on a number of issues. Perhaps I think the first one was the first contested corporate takeover law, corporate takeover under the new corporate takeover law in Wisconsin.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, Wisconsin had just within the last year adopted a corporate takeover law, which was fashioned somewhat after the Williams Act.
Mm-hmm.
And it required, in circumstances where a tender offer was made for basically a Wisconsin company, a target company, that you had to file a registration statement. And the Wisconsin Securities Commissioner had both disclosure responsibilities as well as the obligation to determine the fairness of the transaction of Wisconsin investors. And the very first corporate takeover law was filed, I think, within 10 days after I took office. And it involved a company called Easy Painter of Milwaukee, which was control of which was being sought by Newell Company of Chicago. And I called a hearing and held about a 3 or 4 day hearing in regard to the transaction. And ultimately issued a decision that prohibited Newell from going forward without changing the deal and making another disclosure.
So you essentially held this hearing to determine the merits of the takeover.
That's correct. There was the corporate takeover law, like the Wisconsin Uniform Securities Law, had substantive standards that permitted the commissioner to deny access to Wisconsin investors in a transaction that the commissioner didn't believe was fair.
Mm-hmm.
And and over the course of my tenure as securities commissioner, we probably entertained maybe a dozen of those corporate takeover proceedings
mm-hmm.
under the law, and it was right in the vanguard of those state corporate takeover laws before they were challenged federally.
Right, the 70s would have been a bit of a lull between some of the conglomerate stuff in the 60s and then what came later in the 80s, I guess. But it sounds like you had a good bit of M&A type stuff happening.
We did.
This idea that you were able to really look at a case and a situation and assess, you know, whether it was fair or not, is that the basis of the old blue sky law
exactly.
type stuff?
The state securities laws, the blue sky law, as they evolved from the first one in Kansas,
right,
1911, I believe. But by the time I arrived on the regulatory scene in Wisconsin, it was a fairly well developed set of substantive criteria that had been adopted. mainly in the Midwest states, although throughout the country, to evaluate the fairness of securities transactions. And we had the authority under our statute to look at such things as underwriting commissions and offering expenses, and, options and warrants, and cheap stock, and capitalization, debt equity,
uh-huh.
offering price, shareholder voting rights, the promoter's investment in the deal. And we did look at those things very carefully and evaluate them and had the authority to either require the registrant to change the deal or modify the terms of the deal to benefit investors, or to they wouldn't deny registration, let them go elsewhere,
mm-hmm.
even if they made full disclosure of the nasty terms. Many of them did, or I shouldn't say many, some did avoid Wisconsin,
yeah.
or come to Wisconsin, and if they couldn't get in, go elsewhere. Interestingly, during the time I was there, we did a study of the efficacy of the Blue Sky standards in Wisconsin, and concluded that with respect to some of those standards, not all of them, the ones that I just mentioned, on as objective terms as we could evaluate them, the companies that succeeded in registration were more successful than those that didn't.
So you looked at those who had been allowed to come in and those who were not.
Were not, and kind of looked at them 1 to 1 and 3 years later, and concluded, and I think we wrote something on this. There's a law review article on this that Conrad authored it. Conrad, you're trying to author it.
Okay.
On, you know, the Blue Sky Law merit requirements and how effective they were for that period of time.
Well, you mentioned disclosure, and I've been spending a lot of time looking at the SEC, so of course this kind of merit regulation that you were able to do seems really fantastic in a way. You know, theoretically speaking, everything that the SEC did for most of its time was based on just the idea of disclosure.
Yeah.
How does this idea of merit regulation compare with that as far as its theoretical basis? I mean,
it certainly gives the regulator a considerably more authority with respect to the terms of the offering. Mm-hmm. Now, I know that the SEC's disclosure philosophy or regulatory philosophy is disclosure.
Right.
And theoretically, if you're willing to identify all the warts in your proposed transaction or business organization adequately, you can sell under the federal securities laws. But having had some considerable experience over the years with the SEC, I know that it isn't so clear that disclosure is the be-all and end-all.
Mm-hmm.
I think that examiners tend to require additional disclosure and further disclosure and more disclosure until you reach a point where you maybe decide you better change something. So it isn't that far removed from merit regulation. But clearly, at least under the regulatory philosophy in the 70s, when I was commissioner, we had absolute authority to say, to set the rules with respect to fairness, and it wasn't just out of the blue. I mean, even mm-hmm. though these were blue sky laws, we actually went through the process of of administrative rule adoption and adopted rules regarding debt coverage or how much a promoter had to put into the deal before we would allow it to go forward,
mm-hmm.
or what terms are fair in a real estate limited partnership. That was an area that became very prominent during the 70s. How we should regulate the sale of limited partnership interest in real estate.
Hmm. Are these like real estate investment trusts?
No. Real estate investment trusts are entirely different, and although we had rules dealing with those too, the real estate limited partnerships were entities that were formed to raise capital for development of real estate.
Okay.
And it was the first, really, it was the initial wave of seeking investment capital from ordinary investors for this kind of thing.
Hmm.
And there were some very massive real estate limited partnerships that were put together in those days. And so the rules for that were really developed by states like Wisconsin. We had, by the way, and I don't know if you know this, we had several organizations of state securities administrators
right.
in those days. We had what was called the Central Securities Administrators Council,
right.
which consisted of Wisconsin and Illinois and Minnesota and Iowa and Ohio, Michigan, Indiana, I think those were the Missouri.
Uh-huh.
And then we had a larger organization called the Midwest Securities Commissioners Association, which actually was comprised of pretty much all the merit regulation states, even though they weren't in the Midwest. For instance, California was a prominent member of the Midwest Treaty Commission.
Uh-huh.
And then the largest association at the time was NASA, which did not deal, at least at that time, with any kind of substantive registration provisions. At that time, it was more just general sharing of information on enforcement.
That's NASAA?
Correct.
Yeah. Did you pronounce that NASA?
NASA.
NASA. Okay.
And that organization still exists.
Right, right.
The other two do not.
Well, now, did they merge into NASA, or how did
that
work?
Well, there was no formal merger. Basically, NASA started taking on functions that the Midwest and the Central Securities Administrators had performed before, and there was no longer a need to maintain those smaller organizations.
This Midwest Securities Commissioners Organization,
yes.
for example, you mentioned that those were essentially the merit states. Now, what was the role of the Uniform Securities Act in sort of forming common ground for these members?
Well, the Uniform Act, as you probably know, was begun as a project of the Conference of Commissioners of Uniform State Laws, and the Uniform Act was drafted by Professor Louis Laws, as a statute that states could adopt and provide some uniformity in the regulation of securities. It did not include any kind of substantive standards, although it did permit the states to adopt substantive standards and apply them to the registration of securities. By the time I was involved in state regulation, the Uniform Act had been adopted in almost all of the states.
Okay.
Although not all of the states had adopted merit regulation, although they had, if they adopted the Uniform Act, they had authority to do so. But they didn't do it.
Huh.
Those of the states that did it, tried to, through the Central Securities Administrators Council and the Midwest Securities Commissioners Association, tried to make that regulation, the merit regulation, as uniform as possible. So we would get together regularly as these organizations and adopt policies, you know, formulate policies that we would then take back to our states and adopt as administrative rules. And those rules were in the areas that I mentioned, like, underwriting commission, how much you could pay an underwriting commission, mm-hmm. offering expenses, you know, how you could set the offering price, what price range you can have, and procedures like what you have to do with offering proceeds. You had to escrow them until you had reached a minimum amount.
So you're actually setting guidelines for offerings in cases like this.
Yeah.
Was this
the terms of offering?
This successful?
I think it was very successful, and as I mentioned, we did this study in Wisconsin, and felt that as a result of the merit imposing the merit standard on offerings that cleared Wisconsin, I think we had more successful companies that raised capital in Wisconsin than those who mm-hmm. went elsewhere. Now that wasn't true uniformly. I mean, I mm-hmm. have to tell you that there were a couple of fairly significant offerings that we turned down that were ultimately very successful, including, as I recall, Federal Express, which came to Wisconsin, and I don't recall why we turned it down, but they felt they had enough interest elsewhere that they didn't want to fool around with us.
Hmm.
They went elsewhere.
Did Wisconsin subsequently approve a Federal Express for issuing in that state?
Well, of course, after it went public, it could trade in Wisconsin.
Okay.
It did. And in the secondary market, all of the shares of companies that went public traded here.
And they didn't have to go through this merit-based?
They didn't have to go through the registration.
Okay. You'd mentioned some states that didn't apply the merit standard.
Right.
What were those? Oh. Were there some specific ones that were very influential, for example?
Well, let me think. What state in those days didn't have merit standards? I think a lot of the East Coast states did not use merit regulation.
Mm-hmm.
There were some Western states that didn't. New York had a different system entirely.
Hmm.
In fact, I don't think New York ever had the Uniform Act. Some southern states that didn't apply merit. I can't recall right offhand.
Okay, well, that's okay.
But they, so we didn't work with those states very much.
Mm-hmm.
We worked more with the Midwest, the states around us here, and you probably have talked to some of my colleagues in some of these other states around us, guys like Hugh Macon.
Mm-hmm.
Michigan, Steve Sutherland in Indiana, David Wonder in Illinois, and John Short in Missouri,
mm-hmm.
Guys like that who were, and Willie Barnes in California, he was a strong merit regulation.
Okay.
Those are guys that I spent a lot of time working with.
Just as a historian, it's interesting. It seems like a lot of these merit states, the blue sky states, were the old populist progressive states.
I think that's true.
Yeah. I was interested to note that David Lilienthal was a predecessor of yours. He was a really colorful character in American history.
Right.
Can we get a sense of what your workload was like back in the 70s? For example, what was routine that you did in your office, and then what was unusual?
Well, the routinized part had to do with reviewing registration filings. That mm-hmm. happened all the time, every day. There were filings made. for initial public offerings, for secondary offerings, for stock option offerings, any kind of offering that was not exempt from registration had to be filed, and it would be reviewed by our registration division, which consisted of several examiners who would go through it, kind of look for the points that are required, the merit regulation points, and then give responses to the registrar.
And if
they didn't like that, sometimes they would bring that to the commissioner.
Okay.
They'd have to review that. So that was regular. We licensed and regulated broker-dealers and investment advisors. That was a constant during that period of time. We do surprise inspections at brokerage offices in Wisconsin. And, correct some of their practices. Sometimes we'd have to discipline them if they were not complying with the statute. So that was a routine activity.
Tell me a little bit about the disciplining. Did you work with the Attorney General's office to do that sort of thing?
Ordinarily, the Attorney General's office didn't get involved in it unless there was real serious criminal kind of matter. In which case, we would refer it to the Attorney General or to a district attorney for prosecution. For the most part, we had summary order powers. I could issue an order against an entity or a person, prohibiting them from engaging in an activity or even revoking their license. And then they would have a right to a hearing, and we would go through that from time to time. It would be a contested hearing. They could bring in a lawyer, have witnesses, and so forth.
Okay. Any notable cases stand out?
Well, yeah. I mean, we would occasionally a firm would usually it wasn't one of the big brokerage firms, or the smaller brokerage firm would be selling unregistered securities, or would be selling securities that were not suitable for their clientele.
Mm-hmm.
We would have to bring an action against them and discipline them.
And I guess that gets to some of the non-routine things that you did.
Right.
And I was definitely interested in some of those.
Well, of course, the first non-routine thing I did was the corporate takeover hearing,
right,
which was very exciting and made front page news all around the state here. Other things that came up during that period, the enforcement kinds of action, and that was, of course, the other thing that we did is bring enforcement action.
Mm-hmm.
But there, as I recall, shortly after I got there was a period of time when we were dealing with church bonds. There were some major religious organizations, some of them television churches around the country that were basically selling church bonds to the people who they felt were their members. I remember a fellow by the name of Rex Humbard.
Oh, yeah, from Akron, Ohio, right?
From Akron, Ohio, Cathedral for Tomorrow, who over the radio and television was getting purchasers to buy at $1,000 a crack a bond which may or may not ever have been paid back without making disclosures about that and worrying about the security statute, federal or state. And a number of the states, including Wisconsin, issued an order against them. They got real mad at us and felt that we were interfering with the right to their practice of their religion and so forth. But other areas, as I recall, that we were dealing with during the 70s, there were timeshare contracts that were very popular at that time. People would purchase an interest in a timeshare, and basically they would have a right to occupy an apartment, or what we would now call a condo, but wasn't called that at the time. And they would call it an ownership interest, but it really wasn't an ownership interest. And a management company would lease it out for them. There were a lot of shady operators in that area at the time, some of whom deserved to be the subject of these enforcement actions. Some of them were just trying to figure out how to comply with the law. There were people selling silver and gold contracts, purchase an interest in a silver bullion, but you never saw it. It was presumably segregated for you.
These are the reworking old mines and things like that?
Yeah, that kind of thing. There are all kinds of things. There were investment contracts in earthworms. There were pyramid schemes. There were some penny stocks we were going after it. Mm-hmm. Boiler rooms were always big.
Yeah, this is really colorful stuff. And I talked to a gentleman who worked in the Denver office of the SEC, who worked in the regional office there,
right.
and of course they were always involved in the mining stuff and the penny
sure.
stocks. How much would you have worked with, say, a regional SEC on something like this?
We would regularly work with the SEC, and I haven't really addressed that with you yet, but we in Wisconsin, we in the Midwest, and we nationally, the state securities commissioners, maintained liaison with the SEC at various levels. I worked with the Chicago Regional Office here regularly.
Who was there at the time?
Bill Goldsberry
okay.
was the administrator at the time that I was there.
Uh-huh.
There were several others, but I can't call them. And then we would work with the Enforcement Division in Washington. Met with Stan Forkin regularly, Irv Pollack, some of the others there. I should say that the enforcement people at the SEC were much more appreciative of the state regulators than were the Division of Corporation Finance and others who felt that we were just screwing around with the capital markets and should leave that to the SEC.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't that they were overtly hostile. They just didn't appreciate everything that we were doing. But the enforcement people did, because we were their eyes and ears, you know, on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
We got the complaints immediately. People knew where to reach us. We were right around the corner. So we would refer matters to the SEC, and they would refer matters to us, whether they felt it was a state could handle it best or the SEC could handle it best.
Well, what kinds of things would they refer to you?
Oh, if it was a matter limited to one or two states that was not a huge deal. Somebody was selling interest in a orange grove in Wisconsin and Illinois, and there were, you know, a couple $100,000 involved, or maybe $1 million involved. It didn't look like it was anything that went beyond that. They might call it to our attention. We'd go after them.
Okay.
If it was something that was, you know, involved a half dozen states and several $1 million, we might work with the regional office on it, cooperate doing some investigation, and refer it ultimately to the U.S. attorney or maybe to a district attorney in the state where they're located. So I would say that the enforcement relationship, our enforcement relationship with the SEC is really very good and effective, And we would regularly interact. They would come to our Midwest Securities Commissioners Association meeting or our NASA meeting and maybe be a speaker. I have a couple speakers on our panel. So we were really quite familiar with the SEC staff, particularly the Enforcement Division, but other General Counsel and other divisions as well.
But when would you, for example, call up Corporation Finance?
It didn't happen very often. It might happen if we were trying to find out when the offering was scheduled to go effective, something like that. But
yeah.
We didn't coordinate with them very much because their mission was different from ours.
Right.
And, I mean, we would certainly be interested in their comment letters. We would ask the registrant to give us a copy of the comment letters from Division Corporation Finance so that we could see what Corp Fin was looking at. And maybe we missed something, or maybe they missed something to bring to their attention. But, of course, we were regulating the merits of the offering as well as.
Right, which is something that they were not really doing.
Would
you find yourself in with the SEC, say, in doing amicus on certain cases?
I don't recall doing that. It's possible that we did it, not an individual state, but the association did it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have a specific recollection.
Okay. Well, one other thing that was going on at the time that we haven't talked about are our mutual funds, and I assume that you had some responsibility for regulating those.
We did, and we had substantive requirements in that area that were really, I think, probably closer to the Investment Company Act regulations than our general securities regulations were to the 33 Act.
Mm-hmm.
And we did regulate them in some companies. I think we probably deferred more to the SEC in that area than we did in other areas.
Okay. This was not a particularly good time for mutual funds.
No.
There was a lot of people were taking their money out. And so did you see sort of a deterioration in the quality of the funds as the decade went on?
I don't have that recollection now.
Yeah.
I'd have to go back and look, but that isn't my sense. It's possible that it happened, but I
didn't
call it.
But it sounds like this would not have been a major part of your portfolio.
No.
Okay.
One other thing that we were regulating at the time, and I forgot to mention, that we started regulating franchises during that period. Some states were regulating it. Franchising as investment contracts under the definition of securities. Wisconsin and a handful of other states actually adopted a statutory scheme for the regulation of franchise.
The
Securities Commissioner had that response as well. So, that was an area that I was interested
in. And that would have been taking off at that time as well, I guess.
It was. It was getting huge.
Now, is this the sort of thing that you would have shared with, say, the Midwest Securities Group or with NASA?
The franchising?
Yeah. How to approach these kinds of problems that are cropping up.
Yeah. There weren't that many states at the time that were regulating franchises as we were. So, we would share the information, but there was not a unified franchise regulation scheme.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about again consulting with these groups. Now, I think the Midwest Securities Group went away sometime in the 80s. Is that right?
It may have been before that.
I'm not sure.
I just can't recall. I think it was toward the end of my term. My term ended.
Okay. Yeah, I guess I'm wondering how it overlapped with NASA and what the point would have been to having these two different groups.
Well, initially, the point was that NASA didn't concern itself with merit regulation because there were a lot of NASA states that didn't do much in that area. Mm-hmm. So the Midwest Securities Commissioners Association felt a need to exist because of that. But later on, as NASA evolved, there was more interest in merit regulation, at least toward the end of my tenure. I was president of NASA in 78-79.
Was it for two terms or one term?
One-year term.
Okay.
And by that time, as I recall, if the Midwest commissioners were still in existence, that organization was still in existence, I don't think it did much because I think NASA kind of subsumed responsibility for some of the things.
So it sounds like you saw a significant change in NASA over that decade.
Yes.
What was driving that change?
Well, one of the big changes that occurred, and it was toward the end of that time, was that NASA developed with the NASD a uniform securities agent examination. And as a result of that, pardon me, I am just looking out the window and there are snowflakes coming down.
Oh my gosh.
I can't believe that. What?
Well, it's not May yet.
Yeah, well, that's right. This is Wisconsin until April. Oh, my God. Get the snowblower out. I lost track of it.
That's okay. Well, you were talking about coming up with uniform securities agent examination.
Yes. One of the biggest complaints that we got in state regulators during that period of time, the lack of uniformity, particularly in the area of licensing securities agents.
Mm-hmm.
They would have to take a Wisconsin exam, and then they'd have to take a Florida exam, and then they'd have to take an exam for Colorado, and so forth.
So even if they're sitting in Wisconsin, if they get on the phone to somebody in Colorado,
So working with the NASD, we developed a uniform examination and a procedure for licensing agents in all the states that participated in.
Mm-hmm.
And we did this through NASA.
Whose idea was that?
Well, I was involved in it, and my staff was involved. We were pushing that. There were others, I'm sure, who were involved in it.
Uh-huh.
And the NASD was very receptive.
Is this your staff at NASA or in Wisconsin?
My staff at Wisconsin.
Okay.
In fact, a couple of members of my staff helped draft the exam, the first version of the exam. And as a result of that, we entered into an agreement, NASA entered into an agreement with NASD for the procedures to administer that exam and the cost of it and the price of it and to share the proceeds.
Hmm.
And NASA, which to that point had been just scraping by year to year on the fees that it could charge to the industry members who came to the annual NASA conference,
and
whatever the states could afford to contribute, all of a sudden became flush with the proceeds of uniform examination. And ultimately, before long, hired an administrative person, an executive director, and staff, at an office, and became really quite potent in the area of state regulation.
When did that happen?
Well, it was right toward the end of my term.
Okay.
Probably 78, 79, 80 in there.
Okay, so just as you were in there, you developed this
uniform exam,
right? That brought in some revenue.
Yep.
Were you the one then who looked around and hired a director?
I did not hire a director.
Okay.
But I was there. Yeah, I finished my tenure as president of NASA. Would have been in about maybe August or September of 79, and then I left office in September of 79.
Okay.
So, but I believe that I was the one who signed the final agreement with the
NCC. So you were right on the cusp of the significant change.
Yep.
Something else that's going on, I mean, in the late 70s, this is a time when deregulation is all over the place, and there's the old saw about, you know, regulatory agencies sort of being captive of their industry.
Right.
Did you see any of that?
Not really, no, not among state regulators. We were really... the complaint was the opposite. Felt that we were impeding fair capital raising, and to the extent that we regulated the brokerage investment advisory industries, I don't recall any criticism that we were in bed with those industries.
Mm-hmm. How about NASA itself? Was there any industry influence in there?
There were complaints about coziness in hobnobbing with members of industry at the annual NASA convention.
Mm-hmm.
And I never felt that was a serious concern. I never cared about. I never felt it was a problem to sit down with members of the industry and talk about what issues they have and how we could coordinate our action to make things easier for them without reducing the effectiveness of our regulation.
Uh-huh.
But there were some complaints about that at the time, and in fact, I recall that NASA was thinking of eliminating some of the involvement of the industry in its conventions at that time. I didn't think that was a good idea. I don't think it ever happened.
Well, I know that there were states or state administrators, some of whom were considered to be a little more radical than others in their approach. So I suppose that was a manifestation of that sort of thing.
I suppose that's right. I don't know where I was in that spectrum. I don't think I was radical.
Well,
I don't know if you... one thing that I was thinking of telling you about, if you weren't aware of it, is that during this period of time, during the 70s, there was a major effort to codify the federal securities law, called the Federal Securities Code. I don't know if you anybody's mentioned that to you. It was an effort that was headed by Professor Lewis Loss of Harvard.
Right.
And a committee was selected, a really elite committee of securities lawyers and regulators, on which I was very privileged to serve.
Oh.
And I was the only state regulator on that committee, and we met over a course of quite a number of years during the 70s, and ultimately came up with a code that brought together the 33 Act and the 34 Act, particularly, and the Holding Company Act, into one federal code, and also accommodated state regulation, although it limited state regulation in several areas. It was introduced in Congress, never went anywhere.
Right.
It was a shame because it was really a very fine, carefully thought out product. I felt it would have simplified and unified the securities laws.
Yeah, it's interesting because Lewis Loss is lionized at the SEC, as being the grand old man and all that. But this particular initiative is almost never discussed.
Yep.
I get the impression that folks in the SEC weren't terribly thrilled about it.
Well, I think that may have been the case. Some of the names of SEC alums that are still recognized as leaders over the last 50 years that were involved in, and it's surprising that it didn't to go anywhere. Guys like Al Summer, Milt Cohen, I think of who else, Milt Kroll was involved. I think some of these people you interviewed or some others have been.
So you worked pretty closely with SEC people in framing this thing.
I did work with them, yeah. I was really privileged to be part of that process. It wasn't all SEC people, but it was.
Who else would have been involved?
I have somewhere I have my book here. I don't see it on the bookshelf here, but the list of members, I'm sure you can find.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing that can be looked up.
David Ratner involved. I think Alan Mostoff was involved.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were, after you left, I guess it must have been, you were also on the Advisory Committee on Tender Offers?
Yes.
And that's and of course that's when the M&A stuff really gets kicked up.
Right.
It was, I guess, around 83, something like that.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about that experience.
Well, again, my involvement in that was resulted from my unique perspective, which was as a former state regulator, and Wisconsin was very active during that period of time in developing regulations dealing with corporate takeovers. And in fact, we had one of the first control share statutes in Wisconsin.
Control share?
Control share. It was the next generation. It was really the second generation of corporate takeover regulation.
Okay.
Had to do with not registering takeovers like the first generation did. Because that the first generation statutes were became unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm.
Of course. Second generation, which are still in effect. Provide that in certain circumstances, someone who makes an offer to control to get more than 10%, or sometimes it's 15 or 20% of the shares of what is in essence a public company, which has a unique tie to a particular state because its principal office is there, or substantial number of shareholders are in that state, has to do certain things. By law, and usually these statutes, the control share statute, sometimes called the fairness statute, are in the corporate law, state corporate, as opposed to being a statute that is administered by the Securities Commission,
right?
And it's self-effective, you know, doesn't require it.
And this advisory committee, I understand that there were some folks, securities lawyers type people who would represent takeover.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lipton. Right. And what were the recommendations that your group made?
Okay.
I mean, you looked at all these M&As, these mergers and acquisitions going on, and, you know, essentially the interesting thing here, I think, is that the SEC, and I assume the state regulators, took a position that, you know, wouldn't necessarily be seen as the people wearing the white hats, and that they were generally behind the takeover folks rather than the corporate management.
I don't know I don't know where the white hats are.
Yeah.
Circumstance. I mean, sometimes it was often the case that states that administered a corporate takeover law were regarded as impeding the free flow of capital by limiting what a offeror could do to try to take control of a company. And I don't know whether that's a white hat or a black hat.
Right. It depends on who you ask.
That's right. And so it was not entirely clear, although the SEC clearly did not appreciate the states stepping into the arena, the corporate takeover arena, as they did.
Uh-huh.
And there were constitutional issues. The Williams Act regulated fairly comprehensively the process of takeovers.
Right.
And the argument from the state standpoint, well, yes, the SEC regulates securities offerings also, but the states have preserved a right to regulate in that area and to impose merit standards in that area, and why should they be able to do so in the area of corporate takeovers as well?
Mm-hmm.
So that argument went on for a decade, and ultimately the states pulled back a bit. There were, with the help of a couple of Supreme Court decisions, and have limited their involvement in that area to such things as the control share statute.
Okay.
Business combination statute, which is another one that you find in a number of states corporate law.
Okay.
Now, I've kind of dodged your question because I don't specifically remember what our committee on tender offers recommended. I just cannot call what we said.
Well, it'll be a matter of record.
Yeah, I will.
So you've shed some light on the kinds of things you were thinking about.
Yeah, though. Right.
Yeah. Now, this was after you left, you decided to stop being a securities regulator.
Correct.
And did you leave the government at that point?
I did. Mm-hmm. I did. I'd been in government for 11 years, and I went into private practice.
Okay. And did you...
I had five kids at that time.
Okay.
I thought I needed to make a living.
Yep, that's often the case. Now, were you one of the founders of the firm that you're with now?
I opened the Madison office.
Okay.
For a firm called Quarles & Green, which at the time had a Milwaukee office.
Okay.
And my secretary and me, and we now have 45 lawyers here. The firm has about 450.
Now, with the folks who have been in the SEC, they often spend the rest of their career working on the other side of the fence, dealing with securities laws and
right.
things like that. Has that been a specialty for you?
Well, it has been. I mean, I certainly have done securities really for the last really 30 years. But my practice has expanded considerably. And I've been doing some insurance regulatory work. I represent the insurance company.
Uh-huh.
And in general corporate work, administrative law, a variety of corporate law.
Now, from your office, though, you've obviously been in, you know, looking pretty closely at Wisconsin state securities regulation.
Yes.
Has it changed fundamentally since your time, or
yes.
how would you appraise that?
Well, basically, the MSMIA statute, the federal law preempting state regulation, in many respects, has taken the teeth out of state regulation as far as regulating offerings in the state. There are very few multi-state offerings that are subject to registration. So,
and these are small offerings?
A very small offering might be registered in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
It'll be subject to merit standards, but for most offerings, it would not be, it would just be coordinated with the federal registration. So Wisconsin doesn't really impose any of its merit standards.
Okay. Well, is there anything else that we haven't discussed that we should touch on?
I don't think so. I mean, I think it's just finishing up that last point. The office here is, in Wisconsin, has not grown since I was here. In fact, it has shrunk a bit.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't have that much to do. It still does enforcement work, and Wisconsin still coordinates with the, or participates with the other states in NASA. The state commissioner here is now, the office has actually become part of the Department of Financial Institutions, so it's no longer an independent agency. And the person who runs it is now called administrator, commissioner, not appointed by the governor.
Which would reflect the changes that happened in 96, I guess. Well, if there's nothing else, then I guess this is a good enough place to stop. I've taken an hour of your time.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, I very much appreciate talking to you.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.